Today we conclude our three-part series in the book of Haggai, and this last message. As we start this morning, a question I'd like you to think about as we get going is, how do you feel when the world around you is uncertain or unstable? How do you feel when the world around you is uncertain or unstable? Are you cautious or bold? Do you become anxious or confident? Do you retreat or advance? Because we live in unstable times, and here is a visible symbol of that. Here is an American fighter jet in operation over the Persian Gulf. There's a war with Iran. It's only one of the things in the world. There's a war in the Ukraine. There's tensions with Russia. There's a global contest between the US and China. There's economic ups and downs. There's cultural challenges at home. There's various stresses and debates. And this war is dramatic, but it will end eventually. And maybe there'll be good outcomes, maybe there'll be bad outcomes, most likely there'll be both. It'll pass from our news feed. But then something else will come to fill our headlines and drive our anxieties. Because we live in unstable times, and actually looking forward for a range of reasons, I believe, in the coming decades, instability and uncertainty will only increase. And so today, the title of our message is Following God in Unstable Times. What does that mean? Because Haggai and the people of his time, they had a lot of instability. They'd faced a lot. And so there's something to say for us in our times, which incidentally are for us in little New Zealand, because everything is happening over there, usually, is much easier than it was for him. Although we are touched by it, and perhaps in bigger ways than we might dare imagine in the future as well. But that's another story. So today the talk breaks into two pieces. One is a whole lot of background, and then what does it all mean? We need the background to get to the meaning, and so one's a platform for the other. And so let's start with some background stuff. So I want to give you some base concepts you can apply to understand Old Testament books. This runs through from Exodus through to really the end of the Old Testament. And this is a framework that will help you make sense of, I guess, characters and what's happening and what isn't happening and what should be happening and what doesn't happen. So, a big backstory. The Old Testament is probably better known as the Old Covenant. So there's five key components. There's others, but this is a good summary. So a covenant. A covenant is a sacred promise, usually with God. And there was a covenant with Israel. And like it's like a special relationship, a special deal, if you like. And that deal summed up as this: you will worship and obey me, I will look out for you. If you don't, I won't. And I might even punish you. And so that's the basis. The law, we think of that first coming at Mount Sinai after God had rescued the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt. Ten Commandments and more, much more. Is like the rule book for how people were to live under the covenant. Temple, which is what we're talking a bit about today, is a place and symbol of God's presence in the nation. Now actually this sort of started even back at an Exodus where God gathered people in Sinai and he manifested himself, but also he led people of Israel through there, and so there was a pillar of cloud during the day, a column of fire at night, God is with them. And then they actually had a tent, which they called the tabernacle, which is like the mobile temple. And those things would be in proximity to that when they were in the desert. But eventually, the temple superseded the tabernacle. After a long story. and so it's a special place where the people could worship and celebrate God. A priest is someone who is a go-between God and the people. They represent God to the people and the people to God. And that was especially in the Old Testament system. We're not like that now because we're all priests. That's another story again. Prophet, which is what Haggai is. Prophets are like God's messengers and covenant policemen. Now, yes, they talk about the future. That's what they're most famous for. but actually their main job was to say, hey, why aren't you following the covenant? Why aren't you keeping the law? Hey, this is where we're supposed to be. That's their main job. In all these books of the prophets, that's where it is. So when things are going wrong in the Old Testament stories, it's usually because one or more of these things is not right. People aren't following the law, or they're dishonoring the temple, or the priests aren't doing what they're supposed to, and the prophets are trying to call them back, and the danger is breaking the covenant. So that gives you a framework you can interpret the story through. Another piece of backstory, we've talked about the timing and chronology of this, so I thought I'd do a quick slide on this. People have talked about this before. I'm talking about the yellow bit today. The book of Haggai is about a 6-month period, more or less. Message one was green, message two was orange. And that takes place inside two big bookends of a story, the blue bits. So they are, the nation's overwhelmed, but they've sent into exile, but they come back to restore to the land in great joy and hope, and they start the rebuilding of the temple, but they stop eventually because you've got opposition. And then it actually gets finished about 4 years after this. Haggai calls everyone back to it and starts in the green. And then the book of Zechariah is contemporary to this. He starts just there, but we're not going to pick up on what he says, but just so you know, that is a contemporary thing. So that's the backstory. But it's hard for us to really understand their situation. It is so distant from us in time. I mean, 520 BC, that's a long way ago, in place, in geography, and in culture. And we don't really get it. So if I try and help us to put ourselves in their situation, if I tell a story a bit like it was our story, so imagine that you were a sort of like a younger adult living at the time of Haggai. I don't find that easy to do, being sitting on the younger side of church. But imagine that you were younger at that time. So in your grandparents' time, this would have happened. World War III with the Babylonians broke out. The good guys lost. Utter devastation. Now, of course, actually, they didn't nuke Jerusalem. I mean, I know it's a contemporary ambition of some, but nevertheless, they did things the old-fashioned way, the Babylonians. They burned it down by hand. Complete and utter devastation. The nation is destroyed. The survivors are then carted off as servants for the victors. That's happened in your grandparents' time. And your grandparents passed the stories down. They survived, they saw all these things, the terrible atrocities that happened, all the relatives that were killed were lost, or you know, anyway, all these terrible stories. In your parents' time, you've come back to the land, and they're kind of like this, a stranded ship. They came on the journey with joy and hope and high ideals and aspiration, returning to the land. They start rebuilding the temple, and then they get stuck and stranded because the opposition rises and it discourages them and it stops the reconstruction. And in the end, they just have to make the best of it. You know, and so people are making the best of it. Some people are doing not too bad. Others, most people are just getting by, but the nation is stuck. They're not thriving like they should. They can see the sea they want to get to, but they're just stuck. That's your parents' time, and that's the time you live in. And Haggai speaks into that space. So let's pick up on what he's saying. Chapter 2, we'll read from verse 10. On the 24th day of the 9th month in the 2nd year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Haggai. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Ask the priests what the law says. If anyone carries consecrated meat in the fold of their garment, and that fold touches some bread or stew, some wine, olive oil, or other food, does it become consecrated? The priest answered, no. Then Haggai said, if a person defiled by contact with a dead body touches one of these things, does it become defiled? Yes, the priests replied, it becomes defiled. Then Haggai said, so it is with this people and this nation in my sight, declares the Lord. Whatever they do and whatever they offer, there is defiled. Now give careful thought to this day on. Significant statement here. Consider how things were done before one stone was laid on another in the Lord's temple. So they've started the reconstruction. They've restarted. So that's important. And God reflects back. Verse 16. When anyone came to a heap of 20 measures, there were only 10. When anyone went to a wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. I struck all the work of your hands with blight, mildew, and hail. You did not return to me. Now remember, these are a farming people. So this is a big deal. When the crops go south, it goes south, disaster. Declares the Lord. From this day on, from this 24th day of the ninth month, give careful thought to the day when the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid. Give careful thought. Is there yet any seed left in the barn? Until now, the vine and the fig tree, the pomegranate and the olive tree have not borne fruit. From this day on, I will bless you, because they've started. The word of the Lord came to Haggai a second time on the 24th day of the month. Tell Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, that I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overturn royal thrones and shatter the power of foreign kingdoms. I will overthrow chariots and their drivers, horses and their riders will fall, each by the sword of his brother. On that day, declares the Lord Almighty, I will take you, my servant Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and I will make you like my signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord Almighty. So there's a bit there. What does it mean? We have to unpack a few pieces there to get the sense of that meaning. Well, the first thing it means is this. Zerubbabel would make an excellent name for a baby. That's what I reckon. You know, it's biblical. It's distinctive. The meaning's a little uncertain. But it abbreviates excellently. Baby Zeb. I think it'd be great. You know, Zerubbabel Achan. It's got a good ring to it. I think the family might go for it. Or at least my daughter-in-law Judy would be too polite to tell me it's a stupid idea. Unlike the rest of the family. However, I've got a better plan. Now, our worship leader, Isabel, acquired a new name when she got married. Zintel. Zerubbabel Zintel. What magnificent initials. ZZ. Incredible, isn't it? And I know, yes, the child would be on the end of every alphabetical list in Western civilization, but it's a small price to pay for such awesomeness, and it gets better. If you put in a middle name starting with a vowel, you get Zaz, Zoz, Zuz, Ziz, Zez. It's just a gift that keeps on giving. You can thank me later. Yeah. But anyway, more seriously, what does it mean? Let's just pull myself back together again. What does it mean? Okay, there's two sections here, two messages. What does it mean? The first one really emphasizes you can flourish within God's calling. That's what Haggai is saying. Now, there's a bit of unpacking to get to that. So he talks about things being clean and unclean. Now, like a lot of good teachers, Haggai asks the question he knows the answer to as a teaching tool. So he asked the priests about these particular things. So what does it mean for clean and unclean? So if we look back in the Old Testament, as part of Old Testament law, the book of Leviticus is like one of the great statements on all the syrup stuff. So the clean and unclean meant some things included, some things that are clean would be things we would think of as personal hygiene and even public health. So they would be, they're positive, they're practical and positive measures for individuals and a population. But there's also a whole other layer of things that are spiritually significant, ceremonial and different aspects. So when something was clean, it could be a good idea, although it was all reinforced with God's commands for the health of the people, but also there are spiritual things in there. Now the principle he's saying is that if you have something that's clean, an object that's clean or a person that's clean, if they touch something unclean, they don't necessarily make that clean or good. If they've got something that's unclean, they can make that dirty. Now, the point of that whole system is it demonstrated and taught in practical ways that God deserved the people's first commitment and their best. And that God was holy and his people should be too. Now, you have to remember as well, they were surrounded by pagan peoples who worshipped idols, and God was intent that they would be separated from that and not fall into their sins. And so that was also part of this, provided a safe boundary for them in a spiritual sense. Also, it taught and reminded that sin had consequence. So you could sin or you do something wrong and you would become unclean. And you would have to then offer things, a sacrifice even, to become clean again. Now, but also, of course, some of it was simply practical. But there was all these things, so it's quite important. We don't really have a concept of that in our culture. And as much as it pains me to say this, probably the closest thing we have to the concept of clean and unclean is our health and safety systems that we have in legislation. Because in the New Testament, we're not driven by this concept under the New Covenant. But, you know, we think about health and safety. Health and safety breaks into two categories. It says things that actually keep people safe in their workplace, and then things that help you shift the blame, which is at least 40%. I'll stop there. Now what that does is keep one's practical things keep you safe, but also, is it good? Is it right? Is it proper or improper? And that's a big essence of what clean and unclean is. Is this good? Is it right? Is it not right? Or is it improper? And so this is part of the... So he talks about a couple of examples of this. You can have clean food, and it can be made dirty by something else. If you're handling dead people, there's various other health aspects that can be unclean. So there were things around that. So he says, the problem with your people, his message is, you have become unclean, and therefore everything you touch is contaminated and tainted by what you do. And this is partly why you're thriving. And why did they get to that? How did that happen? It's not because... It's not as simple as saying, oh, I did a bad thing. And they probably did, but that's not really the point of this. It's that they had a calling from God. They had a calling. God said, build my temple, and they didn't do it. They got distracted, they got discouraged, they did other things, they just settled to try and sort themselves out. And therefore, because they didn't do that, that's why they ended up the way they did. So everything they did after that, God wasn't behind it, and he was even opposed to it. So what does that come down to? But also in the passages, it's like this. You can flourish within God's calling, but you have to choose calling over comfort. In that passage, he says, you know, that's how it was up until this day. But note, from here on, things are going to get better because you've started. I'm going to bless you now because you're doing what I want. In unstable times, you can flourish within God's calling, but you have to choose calling over comfort. And they had to do that. And so that was the turning point for them. I think about it, this applies for us as a church, as groups and individuals. I actually believe our church has a calling and we express it in our vision, see our city become a place of Christ-transforming hope. That's what we think. We've been trying to work on this for 40 years with various ups and downs. And I actually do think that God has helped us flourish because of it. It's not simply because of our leadership's inherent brilliance. It is this fact because we are trying to do what he wants and he wants to back that and bless that. So for example, we have a huge abundance of incredible people in this church. More than I've ever noted in the many years that I've been here, which is a long time. And so, for example, if I think of what a typical church is like, we have 10 typical churches worth of youth leadership. We have 6 churches worth of worship and leaders and musicians. We have 17 people we can put into our preaching lineup. This is an incredible abundance. God did not give us this, though, so that we could feel good about it. He gave it to us so we might obey him. And I think our next step for us in pursuing our calling as a church is this church plant. I was talking about this at a church thing. If we don't step forward, if we don't embrace our calling over our comfort, because it is incredible having all these incredible people everywhere, it's just so amazing. You know, but if we just live on that, we're going to go off. We're going to become tainted. We're going to be spoiled. We actually, to be obedient and to flourish, we have to step out. We have to become a sending church of some of our magnificent people. Now, this is true for individuals as well. I think, you know, we can sometimes have a sense that we wanted to do something, God asked us to do something, but we didn't do it. And there could be all kinds of reasons. One is we got hurt or we got distracted, or we just lost our way, or we weren't sure we really heard from God, or we got confused, or any number of reasons. But in the end, we ended up choosing the easy path because it was comfortable, less stressful. And I can think of people, my contemporaries I've known a long time in my life, and they're comfortable. You know, being comfortable, but they're not what they could be. And then underneath that comfort and ease, there's a lingering disquiet. And I think, and they're okay, and they're comfortable, but are they really flourishing the way they could? Well, not, because they're not doing what God wanted them to do. And that's it can be a challenge for each of us. And a really disturbing thing, as I finish on this point, is that this, you can transmit this across generations. So if you always choose comfort over calling, why wouldn't your children do the same? That's disturbing. I find that quite frightening. So our next thing, and this is the last really big point we've got today. In unstable times, you can be confident within God's calling. And so the second message is about Zerubbabel, that fantastically named governor of Judah. It's an example for future generations in naming. Anyway, very personal for me. Basically, God is saying to him, you are my man. I've chosen you, and you're going to represent me. Now, it's quite personal, quite powerful. So I will take you, my servant Zerubbabel, declares the Lord, and I will make you like my signet ring, for I have chosen you. Now, the ring thing is quite a big thing in Middle Eastern culture. We remember this from Easter series. Kings wore a big ring often, and they had their royal seal on it, and they didn't do e-signing in the 500 BCs. They did wax signing. So they had a big wax, blob of wax, and they would just press on their ring seal, and that would be the official mark that this was the action of the king. And so they might give that ring to someone and say, you are acting for me. So God is saying, you are acting for me. You're my man. And this reminds me actually of a talk show I used to listen to, and I just drive around at the end of the day or between things in work. I turn the radio on sometimes, and they had this talk show running for a while, and Simon Barnett was in it, and they did different things. But on Fridays, they did this competition where the three hosts would all each choose a song. And the first person who got three callers in to say they voted for that song as the best one, they were the man. So they used to call it, you the man. And so what would happen is that whoever won, and there'd be naturally lots of, you know, sledging and things and all the way through, the other two people would have to say they're the man in a big exaggerated way. So for example, if Simon Barnett won, they'd go, Simon, you are the man. And if there was a woman in the host, like, you are the woman. Now there's a certain sense where God is saying that to Zerubbabel, except more spiritually. And I've been thinking about this, you know. There's something like that true for us. God speaks to us. You know, we're his people, and he calls upon us, and that's what he's saying to us. So just as an example, how many Joshes do we have in the room today? We have a lot of them in our church. Put your hand up if you're a Josh. One confessing, but I know there's a lot more. You know, so for the Joshes out there, standing in for all men, Josh, you are God's man. How many Catherines or Caths do we have in the room? Oh, yes, I see that hand. A few high. Okay, Catherine, you are God's woman. But, you know, God says it's more spiritual. But you get the idea, we're God's chosen people. And that's what he said, you're my person. And what that really means, though, to be that, you didn't get told that just so you can feel good. But you can be confident within God's calling, but you have to choose action over anxiety. Now, Zerubbabel, everything wasn't calm for him. God said in the first part of the message, I'm going to shake the nations and the heavens, and so things were not going to be stable. And he actually had four more years to go building this thing. And then actually they had a lot of troubles later, which come back in the book of Ezra. So it wasn't like, the nations around him didn't like them. So things were not going to be calm, but he could be confident because God had chosen him, but he had to act on God's calling, and he had to choose it over his anxieties. And that goes for us too. That goes for us as well. And that is scary, but it is the truth. If God calls you, isn't it great? I'm God's person, I'm God's son. Well, it's not just I feel great. There's responsibility, family responsibilities come. I guess one thing as I finish I want to mention to us is that God is delighted by our acts and willingness to serve and the efforts we make. Yes, I know that we are sinful and full of failure. He knows that better than we do. And yet, as we celebrate in communion, he welcomes us and forgives. And so, yes, and I think he is delighted when we seek to do things. We might think we're useless and hopeless and don't do so well, and that could all be true to some degree. But he is pleased that we will step up and do it. And that's, and so in unstable times, we can flourish within God's calling, but you have to choose calling over comfort. In unstable times, you can be confident within God's calling for us as a group and for you, but you have to choose action over anxiety. So let's pray as we finish that message today. Lord Jesus, thank you that you are our God, that you care about us. We thank you for people like Haggai and Zerubbabel, who were your people and in a time and place, and they followed your calling. And so that now we celebrate what they did and are encouraged by it. Lord, may it be for us that we as a people will follow your calling as an individuals, and that one day you or someone else will remember and celebrate what we have done for you. In Jesus' name, amen.